This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Haere mai, kia ora, hello and welcome to Back Chat with James King on Free FM. This is your weekly discussion show talking about local, national and international issues. If you'd like to be part of the program, if you'd like to join the show, just email me, jamesking2020@gmail.com. That's jamesking2020@gmail.com. I'd love to have your comments, your questions, your queries, your criticisms, and of course, your observations. Today on the show, we've got our resident expert on things mental health, Dr. Alexander Stevens II. And joining us today is who, Alexander?
Kia ora koutou. And morena whānau. So I've invited a special guest to join us today because we're going to be talking about that report on abuse and care from the Royal Commission of Inquiry. So I thought I would invite my colleague Marama Hitaraka. So Marama is a dedicated advocate for social justice with over 20 plus years of experience in social work addressing sexual violence, housing, Māori health. Marama and I actually worked on rape crisis in Auckland, known as Rape Prevention Education. We've sat on a health panel back a very long time ago. And I just thought, actually, if we're going to have this conversation, James, let's have a look at this inquiry that was done from a Tāne Māo perspective, Wahine perspective, and then look at it as a collective.
As a collective. Mm. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Marama.
Kia ora. Koutou, ko Waiau, Tapiri Te Maunga, Waikato Te Awa, Tainui Te Waka, Pohara, me Wereroa, me Taupiri, Ngā Marae, Ngāti Tāinga, me Ngāti Kōre ki Kahukura, Ngā Hapū, Tainui Waikato Te Waka, ko Marama Hitara, ko tōku ingoa, nō reira, kia ora. I have been working in the sector for quite a number of years and am a social worker by trade, and so have done some work in a myriad of different areas, so child protection, youth justice, but also stuff around with whole families, so working in schools with social workers in both primary and primary, intermediate and high school, and also currently working in social housing at
the
moment.
Incredible.
And so born and raised in Auckland, but have whakapapa in Hamilton, obviously. My surname, though, it comes from the beautiful Kaipara, and so is my husband's, and so he was raised up there. Yeah, so that's just a little bit about me and where I come from.
And just to remind our listeners, Alexander, just a little bit about you and standingtall.co.nz.
So standingtallnz.org is a service that I created as part of my doctoral research to support our Māori and Pacific men, their support people and community agencies on the topic of sexual abuse, specifically working with our Indigenous and Polynesian men. And then my background is 20 plus years as well, working in areas like sexual violence, mental health, addictions, financial capability, suicide prevention, etc.
All the big stuff.
All the big stuff that are interconnected together. So like a spider web, you just tug on one side. Hopefully the spider's not home, actually. Doesn't want the web being tangled with. But yes, you tug on one side of the web and then everything else kind of ripples and reverberates out. And that's the reality of the work that Marama and I are in.
Do you enjoy the work, Marama?
I do. And it's more that, I think I've always enjoyed the work, but it's more about having the opportunity to just break, intergenerational cycles.
So have you seen that? Because people say, leopards don't change their spots. Do you see that generational change occur in people?
Absolutely. So I've seen it with many families that I've worked with. And often with the people that I've worked with, they've just wanted someone to just hear them.
Right.
And be able to hear their story, acknowledge them, validate their feelings and their emotions and where they're at, and then work with them to be able to put pathways in place so that they can, so that they feel like they're actually in control of their lives. And I suppose with a lot of people that I've worked with, that's been the biggest problem, is that everyone else has, they've felt that everyone else has had control of their lives and they've had nothing.
The area of sexual violence isn't for the faint-hearted, but you worked in housing, you work in housing now, and Māori health as well as sexual violence. What aspect of those do you enjoy the most to work with or to work on? Maybe enjoy isn't quite the word, but you find most satisfying.
Most satisfying? I suppose what gives me the ability to work with whole families.
Yeah.
And so what I really enjoy about social housing is that it gives me the ability to work with whole families.
Yes.
So it's not just kind of on one thing. And you find that soon after having a conversation with that family that they've experienced everything. And so you get the opportunity to really sort of help them kind of figure their way through their own journey.
And actually, James, and this is what I love about the work that Madama and I do, is I like to work with individuals and help them step into or back into family spaces.
Yeah.
So I kind of see both of our work as being complementary.
Mm. We're here to talk about the Abuse and Care Royal Commission of Inquiry. Explain to me, what are the main objectives of the inquiry itself?
Yeah. So I think what I want to do really, first and foremost, is just acknowledge that profound pain and suffering that individuals and their whānau have experienced being let down by state care, if we can just be frank about that. And I think that there's a huge amount of courage in those individuals that have come forward, and also acknowledging that there are individuals who aren't alive now to see the outcome of this. So this inquiry started in 2018.
Mm.
So there have people who have given evidence who aren't alive to see the end of this process. And actually, Madam, I'd be interested in your thoughts, because I don't think we're going to see an end to this process. I think that this thing's going to be dragged out a bit. But I first and foremost want to acknowledge what victims and survivors have experienced. The commission was set up under Labor government in 2018, and its primary purpose was to investigate children, young people and vulnerable adults who had experienced abuse and neglect in state and non-state care between 1950 and 1999. Mm-hmm. So that's the official stance that the commission report has, but it was also an opportunity, depending on the lens that you look at, it was an opportunity for victims and survivors to be heard. They'd wanted this for a number, and I really mean a number of years, and had been blocked systematically across the way. So when it finally got traction, it was their opportunity to be seen, heard, and valued.
Mm. 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 What's your personal view of the merits of the inquiry, Madam?
Oh, first off, I think it's about time it's about time that something like this has been done, and that those who have not had the opportunity to speak before have now been given a platform for their voices to be heard.
Yeah.
It's definitely a shame that it's taken so long for this to occur and to happen. But for me, it's kind of like, now what? Okay, so now people have been able to talk about their experiences with the possibility of re-victimisation and all of this stuff, but now what?
Mm.
Because the things around people being held accountable, I'm not sure that people are going to have the opportunity, or that people, those who should be held accountable, aren't going to be held accountable.
Well, the only way we can hold people to account, it seems to me, is one, giving an apology, and two, compensation. Those are the two main areas where people are being addressed. Is that enough?
Well, I suppose it's all relative, you know, to context, because for some it may be, but the pain and the suffering that has occurred and a lot of that pain and suffering then feeding into the next generations, for some families will not be. Because it's been, you know, their stuff has now been handed down to others.
Mm.
And if you look back into the lives of these people and their parents and so forth, you'd probably see that it's that a lot of the stuff has been passed down from previous generations to them. And that now with what's occurred around how people have been treated within these institutions, it's just kind of exacerbated it even more.
Mm. It's difficult to know what to do, isn't it? With respect to this inquiry, okay, you've got this 2,000-page document.
Mm-hmm.
You've had 4 or 5 years to digest what people have had to say about things. Do you think people are feeling empowered now to be able to come out and and speak to this?
I guess it depends on who you talk to. I think Martima alluded, said that it's contextual, and I agree that there are some people that wanted an apology to at least be heard. Close to 3,000 people came forward.
Yes.
And each one of them obviously testified around what their experiences were. Some of them said they actually compensation, having supported a number of people myself through this process, and you know, some wanted an apology, some wanted compensation. Others didn't want either, actually. They just wanted, like I said before, to be seen, heard, and...
Right, validated.
And validated. But along this way, I guess what you're seeing is, I'm hoping, will be the beginning of something that will kind of create a catalyst of change, I'm hoping.
So you look at it as the beginning or the start of something, whereas perhaps our politicians are looking at this as being the end of something, or the beginning of the end.
Well, I think every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end, right?
Right.
And the reality is, I think that there was a lot of fear for this inquiry to come forward because there was this perception that everyone's going to want compensation. Quite rightly, by the way, I think. I mean, they have been let down by stake here, which we'll get into later on. But I think, so it's exactly what Martima said. So yes, we've got this report that's come out, and what? We were talking on the way down here to Hamilton. We were saying, look, there are a lot of, Lake Alice, for example, that don't exist. So actually, who is accountable when you've got these services that no longer exist? There are people that are still alive. Does that mean that there's now going to be potential criminal charges that might be laid against these individuals? What does this actually mean? And I guess there's an expression as a diabetic, which I love, which is the proof's in the pudding. That's if you can have the pudding. And what will that actually look like now? So there's been a bit of a news spread, as there often is. But I'm interested to see what does the substance behind all the news and all the bright lights and spiel actually look like.
Martima?
Yeah. Excuse me.
You're all choked up, aren't you, Katie? My goodness.
Because I think now that it's all out there and those who have been able to share their stories have now shared their stories, and all of them have said, like, if you listen to what they've shared and everything else, all of them share their stories simply because they didn't want anyone else going through the same experiences that they've experienced. And yet, we have the youth boot camps that are up and running. The youth boot camps.
Yes.
That are up and running, and the first one, from what I understand, is already underway, with the potential for that to still create the same sort of experiences that people have already experienced. And so I kind of think that this could be the beginning of just creating a lot of institutions in a different way that will still continue to perpetuate the same cycle of abuse. And so it's just kind of going through everything all over again. It just looks different because there's different people, there's different ways of doing things, there's policies and procedures that look great on top, but unless you're kind of actually in it, you don't necessarily know.
There's a call for gentleness, for respect, for a restorative approach to life that you don't get through boot camp.
Absolutely.
But that's not stopping them dropping $100,000 each on these kids going to boot camp.
Yes. When actually, if you kind of peel it back a little bit, you know, there's probably other ways that you could spend $100,000.
Yeah.
With families or on families, for them to be able to get the assistance and the help that they want. And I think for far too long, professionals, organisations, institutions have spent way too long telling families or telling people how they should live and how they should react and how they should respond, rather than helping to facilitate people through a journey of growth and development that will then allow them to be able to step into a pathway of healing that would be better for them.
People were talking about co-design. I first became familiar with the idea of co-design, you know, people partnership type situations, about 15 years ago. Mm. How far have we come, if at all, in that regard?
My personal opinion, I don't think we've come very far at all, in the sense that co-design, it's a great concept, and yes, when it works, it's fantastic, but again, you've still got government organisations telling people how they should and shouldn't do stuff. So unless it fits within a particular framework or a particular criteria, or unless it kind of is done the way that people want it done, it's still others controlling the outcome. It's not really people being able to come forward to co-design in a way that they feel is actually best for them. So people are still being told what to do.
And co-design often comes from often from the state's perspective anyway. So they've already got ideas. Having worked on both sides, right, I do know something about this process.
Yes.
Will often have their own vision and values, and it's about how do you support the other side to kind of see those vision and values. I've only seen maybe a handful of times of the hundreds of co-design projects that I've been a part of over many years actually be a co-design process. So I'm a little bit jaded with, you know, when someone says we'll do this co-design, to actually understand, you know, is it truly a co-design process or is it something kind of dressed up as something else?
Do you know if this inquiry incorporated people with lived experience as investigators of the... I mean, who sat on the Royal Commission? Do we
know? Yeah, so the Royal Commission had a number of people from a variety of backgrounds, and I suspect, I don't know this for certain because I don't know every single person involved, but they would have had some people that would have had a lived experience. Now, whether that lived experience, do you mean of being abused or having
mentioned?
Oh, then in that case, yes, I can say that there were people that had the lived experience that were part of this process.
Right.
And one of the things that, the outcome or the findings from that report looked at, well, they estimated 200,000 people had been affected between the 1950s to 1999. I personally think that that's an underestimate because we know that people very rarely come forward with their sexual abuse experiences. In general, I actually think it's, I'm just going to take a stab and say, I actually think it's double, if not slightly more.
Really?
That number. Yeah, because you only have to look at our stats, which is, you know, one of the things I say, generally speaking, as a, you know, one in four women and 1 in 8 men have been affected by sexual abuse.
Right.
And in our Māori community, with my doctoral research, I actually said it was more like 1 in 3 women, 1 in 3 wahine and 1 in 4 tāne. So they're almost kind of side by side. And we know that because underreporting happens and it is frequent, I think that those numbers were a safe estimate.
Why do we have such high numbers of people living in a state of sexual violence and abuse? What's that about?
Do you want to tackle that one, Manama, while I contemplate this? Because I'm looking at you, you're looking at me.
You're passing the ball.
I need to have it passed back, so.
That's a big question.
It is, right?
I mean, like, there's... And so in my head, I've got, there's a lot of people who would say that it comes back to colonisation, and not to kind of get into the topic of colonisation, but, you know, that back then there was this idea of power and control, and kind of if I take all of this, if I take control of this, then I'll have power. But it was really the stripping of, and I suppose what I'm talking about with regards to colonisation, it was the stripping of someone else's mana. And so when you're kind of stripping someone of everything that they've got and you take that from them, that's obviously going to create something in that person. And so if that act creates vengeance and hatred in someone, then that is obviously going to be passed down to the generations. And so if you're so focused on that, then you're not going to be focused on anything else. And so it's going to create breakages within family, within whakapapa. And so if those things continue to perpetuate through the generations, then of course you're going to get all of this hurt and anger and people that are unhappy and people who feel like they've never been listened to and all of that. So I say it kind of stems from that, because a lot of our stuff, a lot of our history is perceived to have come from that. Not to say that that's the only thing, but I suppose that's the most obvious thing that I can...
And if I compliment what Madam is saying, we know, of course, rape and sexual abuse happened pre-European arrival, but, and it, remember from historical perspective, depending on tribal areas, there were methods, and it often involved death. So if that offender, if we use the term offender now, but that wouldn't have been used back then, then it was likely that that person would have been killed, plus the generation under them, and potentially a brother as well, with the thinking that if they're an offender, then it's highly likely that there'd be others connected through whakapapa. Now, looking at it within a modern context, you know, and looking at offenders, one of the questions that comes up is, what do we do with people? Because there are programs that people can go to that report having, you know, good outcomes around, what do we call someone that no longer offends? I don't know, but, you know, like that doesn't.
A citizen, a human being.
I'm not sure about that because I don't generally work with offenders. Or perpetrators. But there were methods in place.
Yeah.
Right? And so when we look at things now, you know, especially within state care, we had people in very senior positions of power who controlled and manipulated their environments and circumstances and inflicted their, well, people that I've been talking to this week have said insidious evil on vulnerable children for a number of years, which has now resulted in these things happening that we're talking about.
Mm.
What were some of the most significant findings the report found?
Well, it wasn't a surprise for me, but we know that Māori and Pacific young people were targeted the most. We know that not only did they have to deal with the sexual abuse, but they also had to deal with racism and discrimination. So I'm talking about multiple forms of harm. If you had a disability, or if you were identified as being effeminate, which we now call within the rainbow community as well, then you were also highly likely to be targeted. I think for me, James, it's the level of harm, both physically and sexually, that was that came forth from the report. I mean, Marta and I have been doing this for a number of years in our own separate areas, but for me, it was a really hard read. I'm nowhere through it. I think I'm on page 75, a 2,000-plus document.
Yeah.
There are moments where I just have to take a break. The ones that get me are the ones which sexual abuse was used as a form of punishment.
Right.
Where children, remember, we're talking about children, right, didn't do what they were told, and so staff members forced themselves on them, and they also made children abuse others as a way of trying to get in that complicit silence. So I think any decent human being would need to take a step back. I know I did a few times and just thought, well, actually, for the purposes of this interview, we have to kind of soldier on.
Yeah.
But that kind of stuff was kind of surprising for me, just the really severe mistreatment of physical, emotional, mental exploitation and neglect that happened, far worse than actually if they were with their families.
Yes.
I think that's probably the most disturbing thing for me too, is the severity and the frequency of the abuse on everyone that was in state care, that it happened so regularly, and that it was, and absolutely agree with Dr. Alexander that it was far worse than what their families could have ever experienced. And I remember in my experience of supporting survivors of sexual abuse and stuff, and listening to some of the stories, and just, you know, mothers saying, I don't know why this happened to my family. You know, we weren't actually doing what people had claimed that we were doing. And so hearing that also echoed in the voices of the men that I was supporting too, them saying actually a lot of the stuff that they said was occurring was not occurring in their homes. And so them feeling targeted. But that time that they spent in state care changed them for life. Mm. And so I think there was one particular case that I was working on that had a number of survivors. And so I think all but one within that particular case had then experienced just a constant stream of going in and out of prison. But they came from families or from parents who loved them and would have loved the opportunity to keep them had those that were in power at the time let them.
Mm.
And that's what the report has said, that many of the gangs that exist today is because of the harm that was caused by state care. So actually, in many ways, I look at that reported thing, they're making very brave, you know, and yet necessary recommendations and statements, because we've known about this from my side anyway, for many years, and so it's good to be named. The other thing I was thinking of while Marama was talking, James, you like a really good example of our Māori and Pacific boys in particular, because this is what came up in the report, the racism was the derogatory names that they were called on top of the abuse and or during the abuse, which is what actually harmed them. Not only physically, but also that cultural degradation.
Yeah.
As well, so we're looking at people with really complex issues, so that when you look at what does that look like generationally, that's when we kind of branch out to addictions, mental health, housing issues, because people don't feel safe in one area, and why would they if the area that they've stayed in has actually been incredibly harmful?
Yes, yeah. Let's take a music break. Who have we got?
We've got track 6, so Smash Proof featuring Jin Wigmore with Brother. I got my elbow on the windowsill, hand on my face looking out to the world. A lot of questions lay awake in my brain, and I'm still trying to suss out what I'ma say. And if I do speak on some things, is it you that's gonna cup all I hate? So here goes. Why is it that when some guy makes it out of hood life, they're like, no, we can't let you. And allow 5-0 to rape girls, then compensate them like they the victim is so wrong. And expect us working people to fund your wages, for you to uphold the law, which is what exactly that I really need to know. So then I'll stare out of my window. Oh. I probably wouldn't get an answer for that one. Hey. I've got some questions in my mind. Looking up at the ceiling, trying to clear my mind. I can't sleep with the that I seen today. Seen a dude in the dairy get stabbed with chains. He passed away. His parents won't pass the pain in. I feel like you just came and let the rain in. It feels like you just let it happen, man. Take away a kid's life just because he tagged. Damn. Why you let us get ahead? Then you let them pull us back right before we see the end. Please help me understand why you took away my friend. A son, a brother, a lost soul. My brother, I gotta know. Got some questions in my mind. Definitely needs more answers.
Do whatever, do you really think it's making it better? Cause what I see is a cold world living. Your little sister, no one has a hood rat. Giving all the hood that fish, all she wanna do is fit in. Why you letting your daddy abuse your children? When they go to school bruised, they're making excuses. Why is the majority of friends that you have are gang affiliated, hurting the innocent?
Very good morning to you. We're talking matters related to the Abuse and Care Royal Commission of Inquiry with my guests, Dr. Alexander Stevens II, and our other guest, Marama Hetereka. Now, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is because you've read the report, you got up to page 75 or whatever.
75 of a 2,000 plus, I think it's more 3,000 if I think about it. It's massive.
Yeah. So if I wanted to have a look at it, where would I find it?
You'd find it online. It's too big, for people to really access. So you'd find it online, and the way that they've structured it is divided into different chapters. So let me have a very quick look. So it would be abuseincare.org.nz/reports.
Right, and you say that in the report it covers people's individual cases?
Well, they give, it's very similar to how a lot of my research is structured, is that they draw on a lot of narratives around people's experiences of being in state care.
Right. And those are real experiences.
Real experiences that really kind of drive home what's been happening for a number of years. As a quick example, James, sometimes when guys approach me, they're often not only wanting healing for themselves, but they're also trying to find their bros that were also in state care that were abused as well. Mm. And it's not unknown to me to do like small little kind of group sessions. That's why, you know, things like social media can be quite powerful, where bros haven't seen each other since they were 6 or 7. They're now 40s, 50s, and even 60-year-olds wondering whatever happened to X because they'd constantly moved around. And funnily enough, if we are able to find the other person, they've often thought about whatever happened to... You know what I mean?
Yes.
And yet we know that stories can be incredibly powerful.
So how did the inquiry gather its evidence?
Ooh, it did it through... a number of ways. One of the ways that I was hearings. They also looked at doing face-to-face interviews as well, and interviewing nearly 3,000 survivors. It looked at the allegations at that point anyway, spanning over 5 years. So research, private sessions, public hearings.
Mm. The interesting thing for me is that they base some of the compensation on the number of years you were in state care, but it also comes down to what type of abuse happened. And if memory serves, you get $2,000 you get X number of dollars for how long you were in state care for, and then another $2,000 for inappropriate detention.
Right. Inappropriate detention.
Inappropriate detention.
That's crazy.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I thought, no, but apparently so.
That's crazy. Because who really kind of gets to determine who's... you know, whose trauma is more significant than someone else? It's like saying that someone who has two legs cut off is in a worse position than someone who's got one leg that's been cut off. But what you don't see in both people is just the effects or the impact that trauma has had.
Mm.
So just because someone who's had two legs cut off per se may not have the use of both of their legs, at the end of the day, their, you know, where they're at with their ahua and everything else could be in a great position.
Yeah.
And the one who's got one leg cut off, maybe not so. And just quickly, while I'm just talking, so my surname is Hetaraka.
Hetaraka, I apologise for that,
Just to reaffirm it, thank you.
Yeah.
And so I think that the conversation, fantastic. The fact that someone else gets to determine what
based
that's
on the types
worth,
of abuse, right?
It is crazy. Mm.
Mm. And that's part of the, and this then makes me think that it's another form of trauma, because you've got other people on the other side that are determining, well, this doesn't seem as extreme as this. That's dangerous material. Mm. I think if you're going to pay compensation, I actually think that there should be different levels, but very clear explanations as to why. And there should also be details that kind of factor this on that's publicly available,
right,
so that people can actually see. It's an odd thing.
Mm.
But that's why we should... I can just feel myself getting hot under the collar, James.
And fair enough too. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think just that... the whole report is just something that I'm still trying to get my head around, because even like reading the summary of facts, like that's quite there's quite a bit of detail that's in that as well. And it recommends that, you know, as you kind of read different parts, go back to the actual report to get the fuller context of what occurred in the report, so that you can understand their findings. But the I think just the level of racism and the level of discrimination that they've had to bear is just quite significant. And the fact that these were adults, and often
inflicting it on children.
Yeah, adults inflicting it on children. And so it makes me kind of think what kind of upbringing they had to make it all right for them in their heads to continue to perpetuate the same, you know, that level of violence on not just one or two children, on whole groups of children. Yes.
Which doesn't excuse the behaviour, but just wanting to understand psychologically, how can you, without being graphic, pin down a 7, 8-year-old, 5-year-old and actually and do these awful things and somehow justify this in your head that it's fine? And which then brings me back to, you know, about understanding the psychological behaviour of predators and offenders, which is what they are.
So what measures have been recommended to prevent future abuse in care settings?
Well, prepare yourself for this, James, but there's 138 recommendations. That's a it's a huge number of recommendations calling for comprehensive reforms to the care system, the public apology from the government. I'd like to probably put a genuine apology, not someone that's written, you know, to make it sound a genuine apology.
Personal apology.
Yes. In fact, if they were truly serious about this, you'd have all the former prime ministers actually on the one representing those different segments. Because especially during that period, standing behind the current prime minister in solidarity, I mean, that in itself, James, would be huge. Looking at how, you know, redressing programs, legislative changes to ensure accountability. So that's looking at those things like, you know, even they say, like Alice had closed down, but actually, you know, in what way are those people going to be investigated if they're still alive? Recommendations that also highlight the need for a care system that's culturally responsive, given the level of racism and discrimination. And poor Martin is looking at me.
Oh, my gosh.
But this is what their recommendations are. And, of course, aligning it to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, which we know aren't flavour of the month. And over to my colleague, Martima.
Yes. I suppose I'm sitting here laughing, thinking to myself, this is crazy considering the government of today, in the sense that they're asking for things to be co-designed, for Māori consultation to be a part of that, for Indigenous voices to be a part of that, for people in, you know, who have been in care to also be a part of that. But the reality is that when I look across my world within the context of me being Māori, I don't see any of that happening now.
Mm.
You know, when I think about what the government has done up to date with a whole lot of stuff that they are, you know, that they're pulling apart and kind of, you know things that are Māori, and pretty much just in one way, my personal opinion, telling Māori that it's if you're Māori today, then it's not going to be an easy ride for you, and yet they're calling for all of these things.
Yes.
Policies and stuff are being put in place around the things that have to do with Te Tiriti or Waitangi to disestablish that kind of, you know, the document, that they've taken away things like Māori wards, all of that sort of stuff. It's like, it's crazy that you would do an inquiry and then you would call for recommendations like this, knowing full well that within the context of this government, it's never going to happen.
And we know that parties in the government are saying, well, we're all the same and that's why we're doing this broader approach. And yet you look at the effects of sexual violence and harm caused by state, and it's not distributed equally.
No.
Right? It's Māori Pacific, Rainbow and Disabilities. Those were the ones that kept coming up time and time again. So when I hear this idea, we're all the same and we should all be treated as the same, it's a fallacy.
Yep.
Because if you, and this is me talking as a health professional, when you look at numbers of people coming through, it is our Māori and Pacific time and time again. So it's not about special treatment, it's about equity, not privilege.
But it's also about the criminal, the perpetrator, in this case, being the power holder. You know, the government holds the power, but it's also the perpetrator, the criminal, if you like. So it's determining what the jury is going to say and what compensation levels are going to be paid out. And also how the treaty works.
Or not works, depending on...
Or not works. You've got the perpetrator calling all the shots.
Mm, you do.
Which is why when I was reading this report, I thought, you know, although it's really tending to have some good bites... No, I'm not talking sound bites. I mean, rather than being like a gumless kind of report, I think that there's some really good chunks and visions that are being set, which I absolutely align to, not only as a practitioner and a health professional, but just as a good New Zealand citizen.
Mm.
I do wonder, though, given the dynamics of government and the nature of them being both offender and defender at the same time, it is interesting looking at what they're going to do meaningfully.
Yes, yes. Mm.
Yeah, and I just think that nothing's going to come of it. That, again, there's been thousands and thousands of dollars put into an inquiry like this with no outcome, no real tangible outcome that's going to create something that's going to be healthy, you know, for those that have experienced it and for, you know, when I look at our state care systems, you know, including those of Oranga Tamariki moving forward, that it's just pretty much lip service, the whole thing. And that we put a whole lot of taxpayer money into an inquiry that was needed. So don't get me wrong, absolutely, absolutely believe that it was needed for all of these things to occur, but it's for nothing.
Mm. Is this inquiry unique to New Zealand? Have others? Because it seems to me a very broad, deep inquiry with royal assent.
Yes, didn't go past me either, actually. Yeah. But keep going with the question, James. Keep going.
What about the likes of Canada, the United States, or Australia?
Yeah, well, Australia had started off theirs as well. And to be fair, I haven't double checked this because I've been so focused on the one here. But there are movements across Canada. I was thinking the suffering of the Indigenous people has been an ongoing discussion. So has our Aboriginal counterparts in Australia. So I guess the answer is yes, there have been. But at the same detail and level as New Zealand, I don't think so. Like I said, I think we've actually, well, I'd like to think of this as a cornerstone of something else, but what that looks like, I don't know. I'm hoping that it will gain traction, and I hear Marama's comments, and I also think what I'd like to believe and what I've seen in the past don't seem to be kind of matching. I think ultimately this stuff will get pushed by victims and survivors of the abuse, plus services that work in the community more so. The inner critic in me thinks it'll probably be kind of, as you said before, James, you know, we've apologised, let's find a way forward. But actually, if we're not actively applying these recommendations and actively demonstrating that we mean business, then there is a continued risk against populations that for all intents and purposes, often don't have a voice because they are young, that or they have some kind of impairment or disability, and so often aren't heard until they're adults, if at all, since we know that people very rarely come forward.
Can you discuss the role of government agencies in relation to the inquiry's findings?
Yes, I can. And
you might be able to.
Well, yes, I can. But can I say, but that's because, and this is... I guess that's why I come forward, because I actually worked in government at the time in different departments. So you had something called it started off with a cross-agency leadership, which looked at all these different ministries. So Ministry of Social Development at that time, before they rebranded, Ministry of Health, Corrections, Justice, all being told to play nice and come together.
Yeah.
Because the reality is sexual violence goes across those sectors, so bring them all together with a commitment to deliver meaningful change along the way, and hopefully with the introduction of this report that can actually be seen, so that, because I'm just going to say it, James, you know, before it was just kind of passed around like a hot potato, no one really wanted to take this up.
Yeah.
And so this idea of this cross-agency leadership was the idea, well, actually the hot potato belongs to everybody. So let's all sit in a room and actually start to ratify and discuss what this might look like. Now, can I say that process wasn't easy? I mean, I was a humble minnow in a very complicated system, but I do think that personalities and politics aside, I think that there was a genuine attempt to want to try to make change.
Which is crazy for me, because at the end of the day...
Over to you. Yes.
Because I kind of sit here and think to myself, why was it so hard? Mm. Like, why was it so hard for individuals to get into a room to have a conversation about how they can do things differently, acknowledging that they're a part of a system that did and continues to perpetuate violence on lots of different levels with lots of different people.
Yes.
And so I'm kind of like, it's just you getting in a room with like other bunch of people getting in a room to just talk about what they can do moving forward. Yeah. So I don't even know why people create issues for themselves, or why there has to be barriers put up when all you're doing is just having a conversation.
Mm.
You're not there. And I only think that the one reason as to why people become quite, One reason as to why things like that become difficult is because you're protecting your own butt.
Well, there was that.
Because you don't want to get fired if you say the wrong thing. It's kind of like, really? So the suffering of other people in community is not as important as your own life. It's kind of like, and I get that, but it's you took up the job in order for you to do something for the community. And then when you stop thinking about the community and then everything then becomes about yourself, what the heck are you doing in the job?
And I think part of that was some, and I stress the word some, individuals just kind of scratched their head and thought, what do we do with this hot potato? There was also this idea that our services, our ministerial service is bigger than yours, and so therefore we will have more clout, which just doesn't wash with me.
Another power and control move.
Right. Yep. So to me, like I said, I think that there were genuine individuals that tried to cut through all this tape and complexities just to try to get, outcomes. It was interesting, James, put it that way, for me to be in that system.
Well, you've got to look at this as, I think someone mentioned earlier on, a holistic approach. We're talking about economics, social, cultural, legal, intergenerational issues that need addressing. I just wonder if we've got enough political will to see that happen.
Well, that's the question that keeps coming up now, is that do we have the political will and do we have mutual agreement across all parties that this will be treated with the seriousness? I'm all about, as you know, I'm all about intergenerational, so I'm always about what does this look like in seven generations to come? Will we have state services, which aren't perfect by nature anyway, but will we have services that will ensure that children that are uplifted won't experience sexual violence and or other trauma, which actually creates long-term issues for them and then future generations that come forward.
And then the crazy thing is that we have, these things that are happening, although when you look at the statistics, around abuse that's happened with our children, not much has changed. In the last 20 years, the statistics are still really, really, really bad for those that are Māori. And so what's crazy is that you've got these government organisations that are there and are supposedly trying to implement all of these things that are happening, but still the statistics haven't changed much. You've still got Māori who are being abused and neglected, and it's not necessarily in the care of their whānau, but some of it's also happened while they've been in while they've been in state care.
And then I think that natural question that comes up is around responsibility. So at what point do we take responsibilities as individuals, families, communities, and then, exponentially at that all the way up to government level? Yes. So I'm not wanting to completely slam dunk the government to say, I think there's been lots of letdowns that have occurred. But one of the things that I do know, having worked in this space for a very long time, especially when we go back to what victims had said, is that other people would have known what would have happened, as an example, and yet didn't, come
and by
forward.
That, and by that virtue, are culpable.
Yes. Yes.
Yep, absolutely.
Put your hand up and say, the difficulty I have is that we're still neglecting or killing 10 children a year. I think it works out nearly one a month through care and neglect, through mistreatment and neglect. So after all these years, even after this inquiry, 5, 6, 7 years ago, nothing has changed.
No, nothing. And I don't think anything is going to change much. The sad thing is, and this is just my personal opinion, I don't think anything's going to change much. I mean, I think about, the 7AA with Oranga Tamariki, and so that being implemented to allow iwi to look after their own and to have some power to be able to do that and work with the whānau, and that now at risk of it being stripped away so that they no longer have power. And yet when I think about the research that has been done, it says that people who are supported within their whānau hapū iwi are far more likely to live happier lives than those who go down the usual pathway that we're going down now. And so, You know, there's all of, which is why I keep saying I don't think there's going to be anything that's that tangible, that's going to be healthy and helpful that's going to come out of this.
And I think there's a disconnect between what people see of survivors, what they see in front of them now, as compared to what happened to them in the past.
Yep. Yes.
And that there's that disconnect, oh, this person behaves like this because this person behaves like this, forgetting that there's this whole history of events in this person's life that has made that person reach this particular point of behaviour, whatever that might be.
And we know with scientific evidence that that long-term trauma, so we're not talking one of it, but long-term trauma can affect you at an epigenetic level. So these things are now being seen as science has actually been quite serious, not only now, but in, like I said before, generations to come.
Yeah, so what has the public made of this? What's the public response been?
So having talked to a number of men in their whānau that I had manaakied or uffied or supported through the process, some are feeling heard. Others say it's not good enough. Others feel, look, we're just going to step back and have a look. So I guess the answer from my perspective is there's a bit of a mixed bag review. I can't believe it. Normally people are, I'm kind of, you know, when I look at this situation, I tend to kind of be a little bit more pessimistic, but I'm finding I'm on a kind of team optimism at the moment that something will come from this that will be of use to help people find a way forward. Mm. What that looks like yet, don't know. Mm. One of the things, can I just pick up our previous conversation, as I was thinking about, one of the things that I was talking to a colleague about is actually with current attempts by the current government is actually, in what way do those attempts, why would you want to do that against Māori, and what are the benefits of it from their perspective? And that's something that I've kind of been thinking about. So, you know, if we take away the 501 and you take away the treaty, how does it benefit them? An impact on us.
Is this report binding?
I don't think it is. Now, someone can text me and tell me after, but I don't believe that it is. Full stop. However, I'd certainly hope, because I think having read all 138 recommendations, I think I got on to like 28. Do not seem unreasonable. And actually, why wouldn't you at least try to take on as many as you can? For example, the disestablishment of Oranga Tamariki, that's not only been expressed by this report, that's been expressed by all other kinds of... Mm. And actually, we're working with broken systems, if I could put it to you like that. There needs to be a step back and actually look at some of these systems have existed for, 40, 50 years? Yeah. Rebrand them. Call them whatever you want. It's still damaged. System.
Yeah.
What does it actually look like to genuinely find services that have been appointed to do their job? Yep. Back to you, Marama.
I think, but the great thing about this report is that it does give voice to things that people have been saying for years and years and years. You know, so none of it in the report is necessarily new. Yes. None of the information is necessarily new, and people always assumed, guessed, thought that the abuse was significant in state care and in foster homes, and that it also validates the experience that every single person who has been through the system has experienced. And so it also provides evidence to other things that people want to do in the future. And so it gives them that kind of leg to stand on. And so the recommendations itself are fantastic. I think they're really, really good, sound recommendations that have the ability to create something great in this country. I just don't necessarily think we've got the right people to implement it.
Right.
Because there's...
Is that at a political level or in terms of the agencies concerned?
Probably at every level.
Right.
And I say that...
Well, because there's a handful of people that actually work in the sector, right, in itself. So how on earth would you extrapolate some of that stuff to helping people understand the importance of why we need to do this stuff?
Because unless you actually have a context of what abuse and trauma looks like,
and
if you haven't really experienced it, then you won't necessarily understand why the recommendations are necessary.
Right.
So there has to be some form of understanding and a knowing within yourself that actually these recommendations are great, they need to be done, and why they need to be done, and how they need to be done. And I don't think people who sit at those levels necessarily have that nous.
Right.
I mean, if we go back to the question about reactions, I mean, some are just relieved that they go, well, it's done, let's put in a bit of lavender paper and put it in the top drawer to be, you know, fired away. Others don't want to look at it. Because the reality is, when we talk about abuse, whether it's physical, sexual, so on and so forth, it's ugly, James. You know, it's not a pretty thing. When Marta and I worked together and we were looking at, not we, but there was some idea of looking at some kind of logo. What does a logo around rape prevention education look like? You know, it's a hard topic to discuss in general. So then imagine a 2,000 plus report, I think it's more 3,000 report, you know, that talks about quite awful things. How does that then become, you know, out disseminated in the public for digestibility when actually even I struggle to read the first 75 pages? Can I also say to you, if I put on my researcher hat, I'm actually relieved of the number of men. So I think it's something like over 60% of the people that came forward are men. Now, we know that men and boys in particular, research is very slim in this country. So as a researcher, I look at this report and I think actually there's a whole goldmine of things to dive into to provide a voice for our tāne, which doesn't seek to undermine the role of our wahine or the spaces that they have, right? But be able to actually provide voices that need to be heard from our space of Ranginui.
What support systems are in place for survivors of care and abuse and care?
What do you think, Barbara?
Is there enough, for starters?
No.
No.
Not even a little bit. And there's probably, there's one is funding. There's, you know, the sector is not given even remotely enough funding for them to be able to do the stuff that they do. And the other thing is having people work in the sector who have their stomach for it, because it can be quite disturbing.
Well, burnout rates are high.
Yeah, they are very, very high because of the level of... because of the stuff that you have to hear and listen to and then help people facilitate through. So,
And as a good example, James, you know, like, say, for example, and we take that report, high numbers of those are within the disabled and rainbow community. Well, the reality is many of the services that do exist aren't necessarily experts or specialists in working with people with complex issues, say around impairments, let alone other things. So, you know, we've got services that do bits of this and bits of that, but actually the service itself actually needs to have really a good cash injection to help.
Yeah.
So take Standing Tall, for example, James, but the time that we've got left. We don't pretend to work with every single person. One of the things that I love about Marama, though, is that we often have conversations that every door should be an open door. So where we can't work with individuals that don't quite meet our needs, or for example we're a bit filled up at the moment, we'll try our best to find other services that might be able to work with them. So as a quick example, we don't have a physical property, so if people with impairments want to do it face to face, then actually we wouldn't be able to do that because we're more phone. So then we'd try to find other services that might be able to assist. Quick example.
Very good. That brings us to the close another show. Thank you to my guests today, Dr. Alexander Stevens II and Marama Hetaraka. Thank you very much for joining us also.
You're welcome.
All righty, that's me for another week. We'll be back next week to talk more about the issues facing our country and the world. Until then, keep talking. They tell me it's healthy.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.